surveillance. There was no other option. Piotr disappeared into one of the Catholic orphanages in her network, along with the rest of her children. The risks to them all were growing daily. Sooner or later it could only end in disaster, Irina knew it. So did the women in her network. Yaga Petrovska, though, was fearless. Yaga and her husband lived on Lekarska Street, and their home was one of Irina's most important emergency rooms, where people came and went at all hours. That was dangerous enough. But Yaga, perhaps because of her devout Catholic faith, was one of the network's most daring liaisons, responsible for guiding children out of the ghetto and across Aryan Warsaw. Caring for youngsters who were 3 or 4 years old, too young to censor themselves, was like handling explosives, and Yaga was taking a young Jewish boy to a safe house on the city streetcar on a mission one day, when the long-feared explosion finally happened. The boy was a small and skinny child, and he looked around nervously. As the streetcar clanked to each stop, he grew more skittish, and Yaga was starting to get seriously worried. The streetcar was busy, and people swayed together as it rolled along its tracks along the city streets, creaking and humming. They were sitting close to the front of the car, and Yaga hoped that the view would distract him. But suddenly the little boy gasped. Something had frightened him. Perhaps it was a glimpse of the ghetto wall with barbed wire. Perhaps it was a mother walking hand in hand with her children. Yaga never knew for sure. But the small boy began to cry and, catastrophically, call in heartbroken Yiddish for his mother. Yaga's heart froze too. The other passengers on the streetcar fell instantly silent. Yaga registered the startled looks in her direction, and then the dawning horror of those jammed in the streetcar with her. Yiddish, that child is Jewish. She could see from the faces around her the thought registering. And that meant that everyone in the streetcar was in danger. Yaga could see from the driver's quick look over his shoulder that he understood what was happening, and she could see the growing fury of the woman sitting next to her. Yaga's mind raced. With the rush of fear, the world narrowed to one question. Would someone betray them at the next stop to the police? It was too likely. Anti-Semitic feelings still ran strong in Warsaw. The streets were filled with blackmailers looking for just this kind of opportunity for life-or-death extortion. Yaga felt panic rise. She had to be brave, she told herself. And she had to act quickly. I hid my fear, she said, in my pocket. She turned to the streetcar driver. She needed to get off the streetcar this instant. Please help me, she implored him in a hissed whisper. When he turned away without a word, back to the track rolling in front of him, Yaga's heart sank. It was futile. As she held the crying child, she felt her own tears well up. She had a daughter. As the streetcar lurched a few times and came to a jolting stop, Yaga reached to stop herself from falling. Shopping bags clattered to the floor, and a piece of bruised fruit rolled under the benches. Someone swore quietly and turned to help an older lady. In the midst of the chaos, the driver bellowed, "Okay, everyone out. The tram is broken. We're returning to the depot." He opened the doors and waved the passengers out brusquely. People scattered. Yaga gathered up her things and the child, preparing to step down into the street and take their chances. The odds were not with them, she knew. The driver shook his head. "Not you. You stay." He gestured to her to get down, and she obeyed wordlessly. Then he calmly put the empty train into slow forward motion. "Where do you want me to drive to?" They rolled along until they reached a quiet area surrounded by houses with small gardens, where the streets were quiet. And the nameless driver stopped the streetcar. "You'll have to get off here. Good luck." Yaga turned to the man. "Thank you." The man just shook his head and gave her a sad smile as she and the little boy descended. Irene would later say of that summer of 1942 in the ghetto, "What was happening was as horrible as could be. The tragic summer of that year was quite simply hell. There were constant roundups in the street of ordinary passers-by. Famine and typhus were producing piles of corpses every day, and in addition, entirely innocent people were being randomly shot all the time. But to the world beyond the walls, it was all largely and conveniently invisible. The Jews of Warsaw and the people of Poland who were helping them knew that their only hope now would come from abroad, and they were desperate to persuade the British and the Americans to assist them. That week, an agent with the code name Witold arrived in Warsaw on a mission from a sympathetic Polish underground organization. He was coming to meet with Alla and Nahum's friend from the Umschlagplatz, the ghetto resistance activist Marek Edelman, and with one of Marek's conspirators in the underground, a prominent Jewish attorney named Dr. Leon Feiner. Along with Marek Edelman, Leon Feiner was one of the leaders of the ZOB, the Jewish Combat Organization, which had grown in the summer of 1942 out of the youth circles in the ghetto where Irena's friends had all been center leaders. Another of the ZOB leaders was someone else whom both Irena and Jan Dobroczynski knew well already, Dr. Adolf Berman. Witold's mission was to tour the ghetto. From there, the underground agent would smuggle himself into the death camp at Bełżec and then travel covertly across occupied Europe to deliver to the Polish Prime Minister in exile and to the Allies in London a first-hand account of the atrocities against the Jewish people. When that was not enough, he would travel to the United States to tell the American president in person about the horrors he witnessed. The agent's name was Jan Karski, and Jan Karski was about to meet a courageous young Polish woman whose name he would never know, Irena Sendler. The last weeks of August in 1942 were agonizingly hot, and for a month Irena had been working feverishly against the tide of the ghetto deportations. At home that evening, even her lightest dress felt sticky with the weather, and her mother said she looked tired. Irena knew that the strain on her face was showing. From the kitchen, she heard the knock on the door. It was a light tap, meant to be reassuring. Irena lived in terror of the unannounced arrival of the Gestapo, but the Gestapo did not tap lightly. Knocks on Irena's door were not unusual. Her apartment was a refugee point, and there were often liaisons and friends coming and going. But the fair-haired gentleman standing at her door now was not one of her teenage runners. He introduced himself gravely as Mikołaj, but his real name was Leon Feiner. Her own code name, Jolanta, was a word known throughout the ghetto, and Irena did not yet understand sufficiently that she had been under intense surveillance for months already, not by the Germans, but by the resistance. They knew that she was working specifically with Dr. Radlinska. Irena stepped back and gestured to the stranger to come in. As Mikołaj stepped inside, Irena closed the door quietly and raised an expectant eyebrow. After all, he was on her doorstep. It wasn't up to her to open the conversation. And the conversation was a delicate and roundabout one. Talk was a risk for both of them. Ultimately, Mikołaj came to the point of this curious visit. Would Irena agree to act as a signpost for Jan Karski on his trip into the ghetto? Would she help show the outside world what was happening in Warsaw? They needed a guide who knew all the twists and turns, every nook and cranny of the ghetto streets. Irena didn't ask the details of the mission. She certainly did not know that day the name of the secret agent. But turn down a request from the resistance? Never. By Irena's standards, the operation was no special risk anyhow. She braved death every day in and outside the ghetto. underneath the foundations of the building at number 6, Muranovska Street, on the northern edge of the ghetto, Jewish children had dug out a tunnel 40 yards long and 4 feet high to smuggle what they needed for survival. Jan Karski and Leon Feiner slipped through that tunnel into the ghetto. On the other side, their living street sign guiding their way was Irena. Within weeks, that small act of helping the Jewish resistance would have unimaginable consequences for Irena and for the children she was hiding. Soon the resistance would return the favor and help Irena. And Irena needed help. By early September, the great action in the ghetto was in its final stages. The children who remained on the Umschlagplatz platform were now sick and weak, decimated by the stress and hardships of hiding, and there was no one there left to save them. By the third week of August, the Germans had ordered Alla and Nachum's railway medical clinic closed, and Alla was banned from the Umschlagplatz by special order. So Alla carried on in her position as the head nurse at the hospital on Lezhno Street, where the sick and the starving were multiplying. Her husband, Arik, was part of the inner circle of the Jewish resistance, and in her own way, Alla was another of their frontline fighters. When ambulances filled with supplies and dirty linens trundled through the checkpoints, Alla made sure that there were small stowaways aboard. Often these children were sent on to Irena. But Alla had contacts in the underground with other people who were, by now, running other rescue operations. At the hospital, the skeleton staff called an urgent meeting early on the morning of September 6th, 1942. Alla was tired. She leaned against the wall and listened. There was panic in the doctor's voices. The day before, posters had gone up across Warsaw offering amnesty to any Poles who turned in Jews they were hiding. That day, everyone in the hospital, even the sick and bedridden patients who crowded the wards, was under strict German orders to report for a final registration. No one had any illusions any longer, and Alla knew that many on the staff had deep personal reasons for their worry. Doctors and nurses had tried to save their own elderly parents and small children by falsely registering them there as patients. They were charged with deporting their families. Alla watched as one of the nurses realized this and broke down crying. Alla had the beginnings of an idea that morning. What if? But the thought was interrupted by the clatter of heavy boots and the barking of orders in German. The hallway was suddenly in commotion, and a doctor rushed past her. Alla stood frozen. She turned to a young nurse with big, fearful eyes, but could not reassure her. "Oh, God, I know what is happening," thought Alla. Alla couldn't bring herself to say the next bit aloud. It was going to be Dr. Korchak's walk to the Umschlagplatz all over again. The thought energized her, and Alla swung into motion. She had witnessed the horrors of the Umschlagplatz and had not thought anything could surprise her now. But even Alla was shocked to see SS men walking calmly down the rows of beds, shooting in the head anyone who was delirious or immobile. Frightened patients in their flimsy hospital gowns were pushed at gunpoint toward the doorways, and at the front of the building, the damned were herded into open trucks for transport. Nurses and doctors ran into a ward ahead of the SS men, desperate to save their children at least this final terror. Hands shaking, they poured precious doses of cyanide into the mouths of their family members. Alla watched in horror as a weeping doctor could not go on and turned to a nurse. He asked her to administer the fatal dose to his father. Alla knew better than anyone that it was the greatest mercy. As her friend Marek Edelman put it bluntly, "To offer one's cyanide to somebody else is really heroic sacrifice, for cyanide is now the most precious, the most irreplaceable thing." It was the gift of dying quietly. Alla couldn't bear to watch. but that kernel of an idea was growing. She raced to the children's ward, where the bright room was already in chaos, and turned to a duty nurse and gave swift instructions. "Run. Tell the kitchen staff we are coming." Alla needed the kitchen workers to fill a truck with food supplies and empty vegetable boxes. Alla clapped her hands. "Children, we must line up now very quickly." Daisy chains of toddlers and small children held each other's hands, and teenage trainee nurses carried two or three infants at a time in bundles. 30 children followed Alla swiftly down the back staircases and into the kitchens, where they were tucked in and among the wooden potato boxes. Alla ordered the cook to drive, and moments later Alla watched as the truck pulled away and disappeared around the street corner. Alla saved 30 children that morning. Hundreds in the hospital perished. After September 6th, the ghetto hospital was empty. By mid-September, the state of the hospital hardly mattered. The quarter had been decimated. 85% of the original total ghetto population of 450,979 had been deported, and those who remained lived in constant fear and hunger. Some 30,000 Jews had been pulled out of the final selections after being deemed fit for slave labor in the ghetto factories. Another 30,000, many of them families with small children, escaped the roundups and were living wild in burnt-out ghetto ruins, basements, and attics. They were ruthlessly hunted. At the ghetto factory owned by Walter Tubbins, the workers in the fall of 1942 included Henya and Nachum Remba, baby Bieta's mother Henya Koppel, and Alla. Soon tuberculosis and starvation would have filled Alla's empty wards again, but by now the hospital was in ruins. There was only one good thing that came of illness. As long as disease continued in the ghetto, and how could it not, under such conditions, Irena's epidemic control pass remained valid. And that meant that Irena and Alla could continue to work together to smuggle out children. Irena was not the only person in Warsaw running a covert operation to save Jewish children and their families. She wasn't even the only underground network that Alla worked with directly. When Alla smuggled children out of the ghetto, she sometimes passed those youngsters along to another cell that had sprung up in the resistance, and to a woman named Alexandra Dargyalova. By the late fall of 1942, Alexandra had saved the lives of more children than even Irena, more than 500, and the system that she used was remarkably similar. Not surprisingly, Alexandra was also in contact with the indomitable Helena Radlinska. Alexandra's organization was called the RGO, for Rada Główna Opiekuńcza, or the Central Welfare Council. And like Irena, Alexandra was a social worker. Since 1940, the RGO had operated as the official German-sanctioned relief organization, charged with managing refugees, prisoners of war, and impoverished residents. But by 1941, the underground had infiltrated the RGO, and under the noses of the Germans, its staff worked secretly with Jewish charities and the Polish government in exile to funnel aid to families in the ghetto. By early 1942, Alexandra ran a division within the RGO that went a step further. She was hiding Jewish children in city orphanages under false papers. Some of those children were the youngsters whom Alla and Nachum whisked away from the Umschlagplatz. Some of them were children whom Alla smuggled out of the ghetto in ambulances and under boxes. Alla could see that Alexandra was on the brink of exhaustion that fall, although she did not know all the reasons. Alla was on the brink of exhaustion herself. But Alexandra wasn't only running a rescue operation for Jewish children through the RGO. She had also become the head of the Children's Welfare Division in a new secret resistance organization codenamed Zhegota. At first, the founders of this underground action group called their network the Aid Committee for Jews. As the RGO resistance was folded into the group, it became the Jewish Relief Council. Soon the organizers decided that the word Jew was too dangerous to use in any communication, even encoded messages. So, instead, members pretended they were talking about an imaginary person named Konrad Zsigmond, a man who very soon shot to the top of the Gestapo's list of Poland's most wanted. Zsigmond was a latecomer to the Polish underground. Established as a working group only on September 27, 1942, its founders were two women who came from different sides of the political spectrum. Zofia Kosak-Szczuczka was, like Jan Dobraczynski, a conservative author and far-right Catholic nationalist. Like Jan, her outrage at the crimes against the Jewish people came not from liking Jews, but from her conviction that genocide was unchristian. "Our feelings toward Jews have not changed," she wrote in a political pamphlet to the Polish people, published in Warsaw in the summer of 1942. "We do not stop thinking of them as political, economic, and ideological enemies of Poland." But, she went on, "we are required by God to protest. We are required by our Christian consciousness." Zofia Kosak-Szczuczka's co-founder in Zsigmond, on the other hand, was Wanda Krahelska-Filipowiczowa. Wanda was also a Catholic and the wife of Poland's former ambassador to the United States, but she was a liberal-leaning socialist like Alla and Irena. The two women imagined a collaboration that would bring together the Catholic left and the Catholic right in charitable aid of the Jewish people. Within weeks, Zsigmond outgrew the mission of its founders. On December 4, 1942, the committee was reorganized again, and group activists argued passionately for the inclusion of representatives from a far broader range of political perspectives. In particular, some of the members wanted to include on the committee representatives from the Jewish political community. That didn't sit well with everyone. And although Irena didn't know it yet, she knew many of Zsigmond's earliest members, a man named Julian Grobelny, whom Irena knew from meetings of the Polish Socialist Party, was nominated to be the new general chairman. Dr. Adolf Berman, the wartime director of the Jewish charity CENTOS and one of the youth circle activists who had worked with Alla and Adam, represented the Zionist Party on the Leadership Council. Dr. Leon Feiner, the man who, during the secret visit of Jan Karski, had asked Irena to act as their ghetto signpost, was the Jewish Bund representative. But Zsigmond's chief link to the Polish underground was a man named Aleksander Kaminski, a renowned educational theorist and the editor of the Home Army's underground newspaper, the Biuletyn Informacyjny, the Information Bulletin. Kaminski was a major player in the Home Army, the largest branch of the resistance. The Home Army, an offshoot of that underground state that had existed in Warsaw since the first days of the occupation, and that Dr. Radlinska had helped to fashion, would eventually absorb most of the smaller military resistance units forming. In late 1942, the Home Army was already 100,000 strong in Poland. By 1944, there would be at least 300,000 Home Army members. And Zsigmond's chief link to Irena Sendler was her old school friend, and another of Dr. Radlinska's girls, Izabela Kuczkowska. Iza was a dark horse, and even Irena wasn't privy to all her friend's secrets. Sharing secrets was too dangerous. In the Home Army, no one knew the name of his or her superior. Many in Irena's network knew each other by code names only. According to secret wartime intelligence files in the Home Army records, Aleksander Kaminski and Izabela were close wartime collaborators. And, like Irena, Iza was working directly with Dr. Radlinska. But Irena was linked to the founders of Zsigmond in at least half a dozen different directions and at the closest levels. After all, She had been part of the underground state since the beginning, and Irena was passionately political. Many of these men already knew her personally, and, despite her guarded secrecy and her careful cryptograms, word was out in the underground that Irena was running an astonishing operation to save children. They knew because for months she had been under constant surveillance. They would soon reach out to Irena. She had earned their trust when she helped guide the secret agent, Jan Karski, through the ghetto, so he could carry word to the world of the atrocities being perpetrated by the Germans. Now it was Jagota's turn to help Irena. What none of them knew was that it would quickly place Irena in the sights of another organization dedicated to surveillance, the Gestapo. Chapter 11. Jagota. Warsaw, September 1942 to January 1943. Irena's old metal desk was scattered with notes and bits of paper, and there was hardly room to move her chair around in the small office where she spent her days jammed in among the file cabinets. In the corridor of the welfare office, the tap-tap-tap of someone's sturdy heels came and went, and Irena thought that whoever it was hesitated outside her doorway for a moment. She realized she was biting on her pencil again. She was stressed. It had been 3 or 4 days since she had seen Adam, who was still in hiding, at Maria Kukulska's apartment, and she missed him. The wind outside was rattling the window, and Irena pulled her sweater closer around her and closed her eyes for a moment. Where she wanted to be that afternoon wasn't there in her cramped office, slogging through paperwork. She wanted to be curled up somewhere quiet and warm next to Adam. But when she opened her eyes, she was still in her office, and the same hard lump was sitting on her stomach. What she was looking at, on the papers in front of her, was a disaster. Irena kept her lists, those flimsy bits of cigarette paper with the names and addresses of hundreds of hidden children, buried in her satchel. There were no hidden bottles yet, for the simple reason that Irena did not yet comprehend the scale of her danger. But she would never work on those lists of the children in the office, not in the open. But she couldn't help trying to work out some troubling sums on a piece of scrap paper. When Irena looked down at the figures she had scratched out, there was no way to make it all add up. She could see everything they had worked so hard to accomplish unraveling. The Germans had cut off the funds to the social welfare office. It was the beginning of December in 1942, and Irena was out of money, pure and simple. Irena heard the tap-tap-tap coming down the hallway again, and this time the shoes definitely stopped outside her door. She slid the scrap of paper into a budget file and waited. When, a moment later, her friend and colleague, Stefania Fischlinska, popped her head around the corner, Irena was relieved. Stefania looked sympathetically at the scattered paperwork on Irena's desk. "Do you have a moment?" she asked. Irena raised her hands in mock despair at the files in front of her and smiled, and Stefania threw herself into the rickety little chair across from her. "Irena," Stefania began slowly. Irena raised an eyebrow. A friend beating around the bush was never a great start to a conversation. Irena steadied herself for what she knew must be coming. She thought grimly that she didn't need any more bad news this morning. The figures were depressing enough. Stefania plunged ahead, and Irena was mildly surprised when her topic was welfare and money. Stefania, of course, was in on the office secret. Everyone in the office knew about the scheme to funnel cash to Jewish families, but the German crackdown had ended that program. Now Irena was startled when Stefania started talking about hiding Jewish children and someone who perhaps could help her. Stefania was a friend, but some secrets were too dangerous. Irena started to protest, but Stefania stopped her quickly. "Irena, will you go to 24 Juravia Street, apartment 4, on the 3rd floor? Ask for Trojan." Irena debated with herself all afternoon. She debated much of the next morning, too. The risks were obvious. It wasn't that she didn't trust Stefania, but what if she and Stefania were both being led into a trap by Gestapo provocateurs? On the other hand, Irena reasoned, what were her options? Stefania said that Trojan could help her, and Irena desperately needed assistance. At last, she decided. She made sure her lists were well hidden, and the next day she took her coat off the rack by the door and left the office early. Her path led her to the east of the ghetto and a nondescript apartment building. The name on the bell read Eugenia Vasovka, and when she knocked on the door, a woman's voice asked to know who it was. Irena responded with the password Trojan. A gray-haired woman with a flushed face opened the door. The apartment was spacious but dim, and the shades were drawn tightly. A man beckoned Irena to enter. Irena could see that the woman was nervous. Oddly, that made her feel better. Irena later learned that her name was Halina Grobelnya. Halina ushered her through a series of doorways until she came to a small room at the end of the apartment. There, Halina introduced Yolanta to her husband, Trojan, the code name of Julian Grobelny, the leader of Zhegota. Irena kept her face stony, determined to reveal nothing. But her mind was racing. Julian Grobelny was a stocky man with a thick neck and a dark beard, and his eyes darted with an unmistakable intelligence under a pair of wild and bushy black eyebrows. She guessed that he was in his 50s, though he moved with the careful, considered step of an older man. Was this a Gestapo trap? Were they informers? It was always a gamble. Irena had no way of knowing that her office friend Stefania was a courier for the Home Army and had a second underground life in the resistance herself. Julian understood Irena's hesitation, and he took the first risk by telling her the secret of Zhegota. They were already partners with the RGO, Julian explained to Irena. Alexandra Dargielova was chair of their new child welfare division. They were working under the auspices of the Home Army. They were already in contact with Irena's friend inside the ghetto, Alla. Would Irena and her cell join their network? He wanted to know. We will not interfere with your current operations. Those words to Irena were magic. Zhegota received funds dropped into Warsaw by parachute from agents in London, and they knew that Irena's cell was broke. They wanted to fund her operations. To hell with the risks. This was a godsend. In the course of this unusual meeting, when I had the honor of representing the employees of the Department of Social Services of Warsaw, it was decided to form our relationship with the leaders of Zhegota, Irena explained later. But, standing there in the apartment that afternoon, Irena looked Julian Grobelny squarely in the eye and stuck her hand out to shake on it. Julian laughed. Well, Yolanta, he said, we're striking a good deal together. You have a team of trusted people, and we will have the necessary funds to help a larger number. Money meant that Irena and her team could expand their operations. But most of all, money meant that Irena could continue to support the children in hiding with the monthly food stipends on which so many of the host families depended. An extra pound of black market butter, or double that amount of sugar, cost nearly 500 zlotyk now, twice the average monthly salary in 1942 of a Polish laborer. Julian explained that there were secret postboxes scattered across Warsaw where she could pick up bundles of cash and messages. And, of course, Yolanta was always welcome at the Zhegota safe house. When Alexandra Dargielova discovered that Irena was on board, within weeks she asked to be relieved of duty as Zhegota's child welfare division director. It wasn't because she didn't support Irena. Alexandra's nerves were shattered. She and Irena were fighting a daily war against inhumanity and depravity, and Alexandra had reached the point of battle exhaustion. Irena understood all too well the soul-crushing pressures and the effects of living with fear as a companion. Irena was treading ever closer to that breaking point herself. Adam could see it, but Irena would not or could not listen. And for Alexandra there was another constant worry. She was the mother of a small child. With every step that broadened the network, the risk of arrest and interrogation increased exponentially. The chances of any of them surviving this were slim, and one had to be prepared for the worst. If she were honest with herself, Alexandra knew that, faced with the torture of her child, she would crumble. Irena had to ask herself the same question. Would she be able to risk so much if she had to consider Adam's baby? But Irena was not a mother, and there were times when even the idea of being with Adam, really being with Adam, seemed like a fantasy. Alexandra asked Irena to take over, and within weeks she did. In the fall of 1942, I took control of the Child Welfare Division of the Polish Government in Exile's Jewish Aid Council, Żegota, Irena said. And this strengthened my ties to the walled district even more. It all gave me more opportunities to help. Anything that brought her closer to the ghetto, and the plight of the families trapped inside, felt like a way of being loyal to Adam. It ultimately made her one of the Second World War's great heroines as well. Some 60,000 Jewish people were hiding on the Aryan side of the city, constantly at risk from the Gestapo and blackmailers. Another 60,000 Jewish families were still trapped inside the ghetto, and the noose around their necks was tightening. Many of the families living wild inside the ghetto had refused to go to the Umschlagplatz precisely because they had children. In the next 10 months, from December 1942 to October 1943, Irena's Żegota cell, into which her own network was quickly integrated, would take out of the ghetto and save from the streets thousands of those children. Irena would make sure that each month some money to support the children made its way covertly to their courageous guardians. And Irena would note down the sums and all their identifying information on her paper card files, an astonishing wartime archive and testament to the courage of dozens upon dozens of average men and women across Poland. Żegota solved the resource problem that had been holding Irena and her friends back in their rescue operations. Now it was possible to think on a larger scale. It was possible to imagine. In the late autumn of 1942, Irena went from being the leader of a relatively closed network of old college friends, pre-war political comrades, and co-workers, to being a major figure in the Polish underground. It was like being promoted from army captain to general. No one who knew her doubted that this was her destiny. She was brilliant. Irena relied throughout on her girlfriends, who now took on larger roles in her network, although without knowing themselves in many cases that such a thing as Żegota ever existed. Irena was the only point of contact on the Aryan side with Julian Grobelny. And on the ghetto side, Irena's comrade-in-arms was Ala. Nurse Helena Szeszko took charge of setting up a system of medical hideouts with a number of doctors, including Dr. Majkowski, the man who had given Irena her ghetto pass in the beginning. These were places where Jewish people could get aid and where sick children could be hospitalized. More than 1,000 children would be placed in orphanages and care institutions across Poland, many of them thanks to Jan Dobroczynski's signature. One of Irena's team members personally arranged those transports, often to rural areas hundreds of miles away. More than 200 children would go to the Father Bauduin Children's Home, where other team members were now the primary operatives. Collaborator Jadwiga Deneka was the hidden children's guardian angel, and she crisscrossed Warsaw and much of central Poland in order to check on their welfare and deliver the financial support that Irena was now able to provide thanks to Żegota. Irena's old friends Zofia Wędrychowska and Stanislav Papuzinski opened their home as an emergency shelter, at immense risk to their large family of children. Irena's apartment was always a last resort for the network. And, as always, there was Adam. Adam was restless and resentful. He had fled the ghetto at Irena's urging in the summer of 1942, only to find himself, months later, still cooped up in Maria Kukulska's apartment and going more than a little stir-crazy. Maria's teenage daughter, Anna, had more freedom than he did, and Adam was brooding. By nature, he was a man of dark and melancholy moods. Right now, he needed a job that had some meaning. It was hard for a man when his girlfriend was risking her life in an underground cell while he had to skulk around uselessly in an apartment full of women. Irena confessed later that she was always looking for ways to keep Adam busy. Now, there was work that needed doing. Adam took charge of paperwork and finances, her bookkeeping, and it was another reason to be grateful to Julian Grobelna and Zhigota. Irena was running a large, dangerous, and remarkably well-funded operation. That meant record-keeping. And record-keeping would be fatal if the files were discovered. But for Irena, there was no other option. "Vast sums passed through my hands," she remembered, "and it was a great relief to me when I could prove that the money reached the right place. It was in my own interest to keep these receipts. Through my hands passed very important sums, and I wanted to be able to prove that they had been received by those for whom they were destined." Her budget amounted to a fortune each month. Sometimes she saw 250,000 zlotych, approximately $750,000 today, come and go. The money came from sources in the Polish government in exile and from the Jewish American community. Conscious of the sacred trust placed in them, she and Adam kept careful records of every zloty. But the money wasn't what was exhilarating. It was the fact that, by January 1943, the names of more than 1,000 children were on the lists. Every single child Irena had placed in the Warsaw convents was still alive. They had not yet lost a single precious one of them. It was nothing short of a miracle. By the end of the war, 90% of Poland's Jews would perish, some 3 million people. But not Irena's children. But Irena was not saving children only. She was hiding anyone who needed to escape from the Germans. For Jewish teenagers, boys and girls, hiding in homes or orphanages was often impossible, and some of those teenagers joined Irena's network as trusted couriers. As German control over the ghetto tightened, the old secret routes no longer worked, and escaping the ghetto usually meant a dangerous and frightening journey through the city's miles of sewers. Irena's teenage couriers acted as guides through those underground waterways, leading families out of the ghetto and delivering messages and money. In fact, resistance was heating up now on the Aryan side of Warsaw, and many of the young people were joining the partisans. Maria and Dr. Henryk Palester, whose conversion to Judaism placed them in danger, were still hiding on the Aryan side. Maria was part of Irena's office network. Now the couple's teenage son, Krzysztof, also joined an elite resistance scouting squad known as the Parasol Battalion, in which the young people carried out, among other things, assassination missions. The special courts of the Polish underground were taking aim at local Nazi functionaries and Gestapo collaborators, and every day brought news of 3 or 4 lethal attacks on the streets. Some of the most fearsome assassins were young women, who used their girlish charms to distract the Germans. An innocent face allowed them to get close enough to pull off point-blank executions. Other teenagers were helped to flee to the forests outside Warsaw to join partisans like Alla's husband, Arek. In addition to assisting the hidden children, Irena's cell was soon supporting nearly 100 teenagers and a group of resistance fighters being hunted in the woods by the Gestapo. What Irena didn't know yet was that her lost friend, Rahela Rosenthal, was already living out there and fighting for survival among them. Now part of the resistance, she had new Aryan identity papers. Rahela embraced her new life completely. Anything else was unbearable. She had erased her past and lived in the woods as a Polish girl under the name Karolina. She had taken a new Polish lover, a handsome engineer, and a fellow resistance member named Stanislav. Stanislav knew nothing of her past, and Rahela, who was still beautiful, vowed to herself that he never would. And when she fought, it was with a raw and reckless courage. She had nothing left to lose there in the forest. She had turned her back in the ghetto for a moment and lost all her family. With access to new resources, Irena rented two rambling old buildings, one in her former hometown of Otwock and the second in a small hamlet just a few miles away called Schwieder. Jewish men and resistance organizers were terribly vulnerable, and Irena soon had a plan to help partisans like Arek and Rahela. Along with Otwock, Schwieder had long been a summer holiday retreat, and the countryside was dotted with drafty villas set amid forests that allowed the contours of the river. Some of the forests were home to the resistance fighters and adult Jewish refugees whom Irena was supporting. In one of those small villas, Irena now registered a tuberculosis rest clinic for a motley assortment of new patients. An elderly Jewish woman with particularly Aryan looks and good identity papers named Mrs. Zussman ran the day-to-day operations at the refuge in Schwieder. A streetcar line connected downtown Warsaw with the village, and, using her cover as a city social worker, Irena visited the clinic often, bringing Mrs. Zussman money, underground doctors, or forged identity papers. The station at Schwieder was nothing more than a platform in the woods, and when Irena stepped off the train one day, she wrapped her coat tightly around herself and set off for the villa on foot over the frozen winter ground. When she arrived, Auntie Zussman quickly shooed her, tut-tutting, into the back kitchen to sit by the fire, and over a cup of tea, the women settled down to business quickly. Irena never stayed long, and soon dusk would be coming. She needed to get back to Warsaw shortly. But first Irena insisted that Mrs. Zussman tell her how each of the men was faring. There were 5 Jewish men with her that day, Mrs. Zussman explained. Some of them were frail from a winter in the forests, and all of them were tired of always running. From one of the rooms nearby came the sound of someone coughing. Irena raised her eyebrow. "One of the residents is a doctor. We are managing," Mrs. Zussman assured her. Irena smiled her relief. "Dr. Bazehesa?" Roman Bazehesa was a sad story, and Irena worried about the Jewish doctor. He had come to Warsaw from the east, from the town of Lviv, and for months Dr. Bazehesa scrambled to hide alone on the Aryan side from the German pursuers. But the doctor had such strongly Semitic looks that it was impossible. He lived in constant terror, and only his sleepless vigilance saved him. More than once he fled a retreat in the small hours of the morning, steps ahead of Polish blackmailers and the Gestapo. At last he was broken by the strain. Better to die quietly than to live this animal existence. Just as Roman Bazehesa hoisted himself over the balustrade to throw himself into the icy river, where he would perish, Maria Palester passed him on the street and put out her hand to stop him. Maria understood all too well the doctor's desperation. More than 20 Jewish people passed through her apartment emergency room during the war, and more than half of them were killed as a result of blackmail and betrayal by Schmaltzovnik. Maria, nevertheless, led Roman home, and within hours Irena's network had swung into motion to help him. Irena herself had introduced him to the hideout in Schwieder. Mrs. Zussman was reassuring, and Irena could feel the warm tea relaxing her nerves for a few moments. A moment later, everything was electric. Fists pounded furiously on the front door of the villa. Irena's chair clattered to the floor as she reached for the identity papers. Jesus, the Gestapo? The identity papers were a death sentence. The women exchanged a horrified look, and from behind her, Irena could hear the muffled sound of feet in quiet motion. Irena lifted a finger to Mrs. Zussman and pointed her toward the front doorway. That silent gesture spoke volumes. 1 minute, it said. Give me 1 minute. Mrs. Zussman nodded and walked slowly and loudly toward the sound of the pounding. Coming, dearies, coming! Minutes were everything now. The men crouched low, waiting, and Irena smiled quickly at the doctor, trying to stay calm. As Mrs. Zussman fiddled with the lock on the front door, to the howls of the impatient men outside, Irena and the five refugees slipped out the back door. The sharp cold air bit at her lungs as she ran with all her might toward the waiting forest. They scattered in all directions, and in a quiet copse, Irena stopped at last, heart pounding. The men were now far into the woods. No one would return to the house until Mrs. Zussman's fate was settled, and Irena knew that the chances of the Jewish matron's survival were slim. But Irena could not leave the old auntie without knowing. She hid the papers carefully among the forest leaves, then crept quietly back toward the villa. The scene unfolding on the front doorstep astonished her. Hands on her hips and eyes blazing with fury, Mrs. Zussman was yelling at her unwelcome visitors. Irena took in instantly that they were Polish blackmailers and not Germans. "We know you are a Jewish den. Give us money." Mrs. Zussman knew perfectly well that to give the blackmailers anything was to be forever in their power. Once there was no more money, they would still call the Gestapo, and she was fighting for her life in that moment. So she drew herself up and went on a wonderfully dramatic counterattack. "How dare you disturb the peace of a Polish Christian?" she berated them. "You foul bandits! I will have the Germans come arrest you for coming to abuse an old lady." Shocked, the blackmailers stood for a moment on the doorstep, hesitating. Mrs. Zussman carried on screaming out her outrage and indignation. Confused and rattled, the Schmaltzovniks looked at each other. Then they turned on their heels and ran away down the driveway. Behind them echoed the shrill voice of Mrs. Zussman, ordering them to come back that very instant. When Irena stepped from the shadows afterward, she and Mrs. Zussman laughed tearfully at the old woman's brazen courage and good acting. But there was nothing funny about the situation. The hideout was burned, as people said in those days. As the dusk settled over Zvider, Irena had to figure out now where, at a moment's notice, she was going to relocate 6 Jewish people. For an immediate answer, Irena turned to those closest to her that December, Maria Kukulska and Adam. Irena knew that, if necessary, Maria would find room for Roman Bazehesa, too. Maria Kukulska was another of Dr. Redlinska's girls, at least after a fashion. Before the war, she had been a favorite student of the celebrated educational theorist and social welfare professor, Dr. Vladislav Spasovsky, a colleague and friend of Helena Radlinska's. But she and Irena had known each other for years from local meetings of the Polish Socialist Party. A teacher by training, Maria led courses in the underground wartime university. But perhaps most important, Maria Kukulska had an adolescent daughter named Anna, a comely girl with soft brown hair and a trusting and apparently unthinking disposition. Teenage impulsiveness might easily have killed both Adam and Irena that winter. It started so simply. Warsaw had been known before the war as the Paris of the East, and the small, brightly colored squares that still dotted the city in late 1942 were pretty and romantic. Anna walked arm in arm with a girlfriend, showing off their figures. As they strolled, Anna caught the eye of 2 handsome Polish boys, named Jurek and Jerzy, hanging out in the square. Yurik decided to set his cap on Anna instantly. With all the subtle charm of youth, Yurik began to stare at her until she noticed him. Soon their eyes met. Before long, the four teenagers were talking and flirting. Anna was smitten. Hoping to continue this pleasant interlude, Anna, with the unthinking confidence of an adolescent, invited both boys home with her to meet her mother and their lodgers, an attorney named Adam and a doctor named Roman. As Anna came bouncing into the apartment at number 15 Markovska Street with the two young strangers, Yerzhe saw in an instant that her mother's look was one of raw horror. Maria hurried into the back bedroom, and now there were murmurs of a heated argument in hushed voices. When the door opened at last, a tiny blonde woman with blazing blue eyes stepped out to meet them. Maria's worried eyes scolded Anna, who obediently followed her angry mother down the hallway. Yurik could see that Anna was in trouble. But Yerzhe's focus was all on this small woman standing in front of them on the carpet. He could see her making an instant assessment. Perhaps, he says, more than 70 years later, Irena Sendler could tell by looking at them for a long moment that they were two Jewish boys on the run from the ghetto. They had been loitering in the square because they had nowhere else to go. Yurik and Yerzhe had narrowly escaped a Gestapo roundup at a safe house on Idzikovskiego Street. They had survived the raid only by crawling out a rooftop window and running. Perhaps Irena believed the wild story they told her now, when they hinted, knowingly, that they were brave young Polish resistance fighters. The boys, at any rate, were brazen actors. Yurik had taken to heart the advice of a wise old man, who had told him that the key to survival outside the ghetto was forgetting. Forget that you have something in common with the Jewish tribe. Act as if you are not concerned. But if you ask Yerzhe, whose name today is Yoram Gross and who lives in Australia, he will tell you that not much got past Irena Sendler. Irena listened, and then she nodded, and that was it. The boys were not only allowed to stay, but they soon became part of Irena and Adam's extended wartime family. And when Adam and Roman stepped from the back bedroom to meet them too, Yerzhe understood in an instant why their arrival had caused Maria Kukulska such a panic. Yerzhe could see plainly that Adam Selnikier was Jewish. So was Roman Bazahesa. Yerzhe and Yurik came and went often from Adam's hideout as Yurik's romance with Anna deepened, and there was always a risk in any new foot traffic. But the person who posed the greatest danger to Adam was Irena. Irena was a major player in the underground now, in charge of 8 or 9 different safe houses across the city, still moving Jewish families across the ghetto walls and hiding hundreds upon hundreds of children. The Gestapo was already hunting for Yolanta. They simply did not know yet that Yolanta was Irena. Irena watched carefully everywhere she went, to be sure she was not being tailed, but it was impossible to be sure that no one was watching. If she misjudged, she knew that any day she might lead the Germans right to Adam. It would have been wiser to stay away from anywhere Adam was hiding, wiser to keep her love affair and her underground business separate. But Irena was in love. She could not bear the idea of living with this kind of grinding uncertainty and not being with Adam. And Adam could not bear to be idle. So Maria Kukulska's apartment also became a regular meeting place for the Zhegota cell. Maria was involved in many aspects of Irena's secret network, and was doing more than just hiding Adam and Roman. That meant they were both anxious to take every precaution. To hedge their bets, the women set in place a complex system of codes and signals. On her approach to the Praga district, Irena scanned the faces of loitering strangers and watched carefully in the reflections of shop windows to see if she was being followed. The area was dangerous. in the old state mint at number 18 Markovska Street. The underground was busy forging fake German stamps and identity papers. Not far away were German barracks. Sometimes, paranoid with worry, she would change her destination at the last minute